This is an interview with Adrian Verhul on July 2nd, 1998 in UN headquarters in New York City, and I'm Jean Craig. Okay. Well, we will be discussing your role in Cambodia. And just to start the interview and lay down a little bit of general information, on March 15th, 1992, the United Nations Transitional Authority in Cambodia, UNTAC, was established in Phnom Penh following Security Council Resolution 754 of 1992 to implement the Paris Peace Agreement. UNTAC consisted of seven distinct components, one of which was the human rights component, of which you were a part. So would you describe how you were recruited or how you joined the Cambodian mission, and also tell us just a little bit of something about your background? You had been telling me earlier that your background was in international law.
Right. Now let me start with the background.
Okay, and then we'll move forward.
Take it from there chronologically and go into the recruitment for UNTAC. After I graduated from university, I had to do my military service, which is compulsory in the Netherlands, and I joined the Navy. And I was hired there to teach international law to midshipmen at the Naval Academy. By the time that my tour of duty had ended, there was a vacancy for an assistant professor in international relations at the Academy. I took that. Taught there for some time and thought that this was nice but not entirely satisfying. So when the opportunity came up to do the competitive group examinations for the UN in Holland, I did so. I passed and was offered a job in Geneva. I did the exam in legal affairs and I ended up in the Center for Human Rights in Geneva.
Okay.
Now, so this is how I came to the UN, and this will also explain how I went to UNTAC. In Geneva, I didn't find my work to be very interesting. I also had good personal reasons to look for something else. And UNTAC was, at the time, the talk of the town in the UN, the big operation. There was a great deal of interest in making sure that it worked. This was it. The UN was put to the test. Optimism that the UN could do post-Cold War a lot of good around the world, but Cambodia was an important endeavor, and all staff members were encouraged to go, and I thought this is nice, there's a human rights component in it, I should go.
Yeah.
And I applied already in 92, because the planning for the operation had started already.
Mm-hmm.
The Paris agreements had been accepted and endorsed by the Security Council. Planning for UNTAC had started, and staff members were asked to indicate their willingness to go. So it took some time and some administrative hurdles to get there. One of the problems was that in the field there wasn't enough accommodation at the time to be able to absorb all the staff, so that we had to wait some time. Eventually, I arrived in Phnom Penh in early June.
Okay.
92. There was an introduction program, and I then joined the human rights component, which was headed by Dennis McMillan. So, when I met him, I came into the component. There was some debate on what shall we do, and I was asked whether I could stay at headquarters in Phnom Penh rather than go out into the field to become a provincial human rights officer, which I really have wanted. I wanted to be as deep as possible in the jungle. But instead, I was asked to stay in Phnom Penh to develop a human rights information campaign. point, I should explain the mandate or terms of reference of the human rights component.
Right, that would be very useful, okay.
Under the Paris Agreement, the idea was that the United Nations should help foster an environment in which human rights would be respected. I forget the exact language, but this was...
Mm-hmm.
And also to make sure to, that there would not be a return to the policies and practices of the past. Now this particular sentence refers to the genocide.
There's not
the word genocide is not used in the Paris Agreement. This is what you have, the return to the policies and practices of the past. And an important task of the UN would be to ensure that that did not happen, to foster an environment with respect for human rights would be ensured.
Okay.
And the human rights component in particular had, I think, four particular tasks. One was a human rights education campaign to install the notion of knowledge of human rights at all levels of Cambodian society. Two, conduct human rights oversight of the entire Cambodian machinery for the administration of justice. To investigate human rights abuses and also to undertake reform of the machinery. Now this in any country would have been a daunting task, but in Cambodia it was especially difficult because there was no machinery for the administration of justice. The notion of human rights was non-existent. There was no independent judiciary. There was no free press. It was very difficult to work in that environment. So in other words, we had to start from scratch, trying to explain what human rights were, what they meant, at the same time try and assist the Cambodians in setting up adequate machinery for the protection of human rights. And this against the background of widespread political intimidation, abuse of authority, and also against the background of the larger political movement towards elections and democratic constitutions at the end of the road.
Right.
So there was a political context in which this took place. Human rights, the role of human rights was basically to support that, to help foster an environment in which elections could be held, which then in turn would lead to legitimate government. And this was to be the and peace, of course, so stopping the fighting between the different factions. The idea would be they would all then join together in parliament or in the government. Fighting would be over. We would have a legitimate government, and that would be it.
Mm-hmm.
But that was a major thing. I mean, it was not as nice.
That was a huge goal.
Absolutely. So this was the task of the human rights, and in that, my main task was A, to develop this information campaign. If you like, you can call it propaganda. We used television, radio, print, local artists, a lot of interesting stuff. And also what I did was keep liaison with local human rights NGOs. That was interesting and fun. It meant sometimes going out into the suburb of Phnom Penh or the countryside to meet a guy in a village who had set up an NGO on human rights, and I went out to see how serious it was. Many of them did it because they knew there was money involved. A lot of embassies and others willing to supply funds, but the genuine NGOs, we went there, we taught their members, we gave courses, we helped them set up their systems, a bit of assistance in administration, fundraising, gave them international exposure,
mm-hmm.
involved them, linked them up with others. That was another part of my work. Then thirdly, I was also involved in some of the more sort of diplomatic activities, selling the human rights work to the diplomatic community, so maintaining contact with the diplomats in Phnom Penh.
Okay.
I went to Geneva, back to Geneva, a few occasions during the subcommission and the Commission on Human Rights to lobby for specific goals, which you can talk about later. And the fourth element was to conduct investigations into serious human rights abuses. Basically, everybody in the component did that. Because it took, you know, very few, sometimes we had four or five investigations going at the same time, so everybody had to pitch in and do their bit.
Okay.
There was a specialized investigations unit, and they did most of that, but I've been involved in some of them. That was, I think this is a fairly good idea of what I did.
Okay. Yes, you actually touched on a number of things that then I'd like to go back into in greater detail. When you were and I were talking earlier, you had mentioned a couple of things that I wanted to sort of get down for the record. Because I was trying to establish whether the parties themselves had really felt that human rights was an important issue, and you know how engaged they were in the whole concept of human rights, or whether that was something that was more or less coming from the outside. And so we had been talking about the Paris peace agreements and the component of human rights that had were in the agreement, and then what came later in terms of the Security Council mandate.
Well, the Security Council mandate was the carbon copy of the Paris agreements.
Okay.
What had been hammered out there, the Council was not going to tangle with. The
okay.
Council was needed to establish the operation, to give its blessing to this undertaking. As to the human rights element in the Paris Agreement, I'm not 100% familiar with its history, but the prevailing feeling at the time was that this was at the insistence of a major Western powers involved in the negotiations, in particular the U.S.
Okay.
And it was very closely linked to fears of the Khmer Rouge. You know, this return of policies and practices of the past was an important motivation to put human rights in there. The Cambodian people had suffered at the hands of their own. And there was this idea that we should prevent it and put something better in its place.
Mm-hmm. And they didn't want to use the word genocide.
No.
So they avoided that by using the phrase.
The Khmer Rouge itself was a party to the negotiations.
Yeah.
Genocide has other legal connotations, which I think everybody wanted to avoid.
Right.
It's a familiar dilemma for peacekeeping, I suppose. In order to make peace, you sometimes have to make peace with crooks.
Mm-hmm.
This is one of those examples.
And then you had mentioned that when the human rights component was originally established, that its role was really envisioned to more or less make sure that the human rights aspect of each of the other components was falling into place, rather than to be
right.
A more independent.
During the initial planning stage of UNTAC,
yeah.
The idea was that human rights would be a responsibility of the entire operations. In other words,
yeah.
Civilian police, civilian administration, the electoral component, repatriation, military, who knows, information, all these elements would make human rights a part of their concerns. And the human rights component would thus be a small coordinating policy setting office at headquarters. And I think it became apparent quite quickly that this would not have worked. Human rights work, by its very nature, is proactive and to some extent antagonistic. You have to tell parties things they don't want to hear. And you have to go out and do things. And this could not be reconciled very easily with the kind of work that civil administration was supposed to do, electoral was supposed to do, CIVPOL and others. It required a certain attitude as well as a certain expertise which these components did not have.
Okay.
So the concern of the director at the time, Dennis McNamara, I think praise goes to him for having pushed this. But, look, I can't work this way. This is we cannot achieve our mandate with these meager means. And to assume that everybody will make this a separate concern, that's a rather big assumption. And let's make sure that we have the staff to do it. So instead, there was to be a larger headquarter in Phnom Penh. It wasn't very big, 11 professionals, I think,
altogether. Oh, okay.
But then with each of the provinces, a human rights officer at the headquarters of the civil administration with his own particular mandate and means. That was a big battle to ensure that everybody got the means to do their job. We called the radio, the telephone, the faxes.
Yeah.
And that wasn't always easy.
But you did have human rights officers in each of the provinces?
Right.
Except,
by the way, for the area controlled by the Khmer Rouge. And we did make an effort to get somebody in there. We tried to push that. It's very important also for the impartiality of the UN when we speak up against human rights violations by the Hun Sen faction.
Mm-hmm.
They come back to us and say, look, why are you condemning us, the other side? Which is doing stuff as well. So, well, we can't go in there. So we did make an effort to go in there. Also to the area controlled by Kunsenbeck, KPNLF.
Yeah.
In, what is it? Northeast of the northwest of the country. We did make efforts to go in there.
Now, you had mentioned also to me earlier that Dennis McNamara had been, his background had been involved in the refugee camps in Thailand prior to his post in Cambodia. Was that an important aspect to have someone to take on the leadership role in human rights that knew something about the...
Absolutely. The major challenge in human rights work in Cambodia would be to translate a concept hardly known in Cambodia into something that the Cambodians would understand. There is no tradition of human rights in that country. It would have to be introduced. Now, his experience was relevant because one of the things he did was set up human rights education campaigns in the camps in Thailand. And so there was a ready-made program, there was expertise, there were documents, and that could be, he could start running that very important aspect of the operation. But there was already an element of cultural sensitivity involved. Some of the local staff from the camps who returned could be put to work in Cambodia itself. Some of the international staff too took with them. They had relevant experience and understood the Khmer mentality a bit better.
Okay. No, also, I'm just drawing on a number of things that you had talked about earlier. But in terms of the campaign that you were running, the information campaign, or as you said, could be called propaganda, what was it that you were trying to achieve? What were what kind of information were you getting out there, and what did you want to be the response?
That was a difficult question, because we didn't want to raise expectations very highly. If you translate the Universal Declaration and you take it to a Khmer family, they will laugh at you and say, look, what are you talking about? Freedom of the press? What is it? You never had that. To have a lawyer present during interrogation? What is a lawyer? What is interrogation?
Right.
We're being beaten, that's it, and put into jail. What is freedom of association? There were basically all these concepts that we would have to translate in an acceptable fashion without raising unduly high expectations. We also did not want people en masse to go out and claim their rights, because that would endanger them. So it was just trying to sell these as ambitions. This is what Cambodia should aspire to. Cambodia as a nation, and the Cambodians should do. The political parties for which you are going to vote should have this in their program. This is what something that you should try to endeavor in the long run. These are basically also sold it, not as some foreign concept that comes falling out of the sky that some Western nations have put together. No, it's basic elements of justice. Something that they understood from their national culture. We try to borrow from the teachings of the monks, from the local culture, elements which resembled human rights.
Okay.
And it was a very simple, straightforward concept of justice. You don't want to be beaten when you are arrested,
for example.
Okay. You don't want to be arrested without any reason. Everybody you were telling, they were nodding yes, and they recognized that these things were happening, and that they shouldn't happen.
Okay.
So it wasn't a very complicated legal teaching. It was simply trying to convey basic notions of justice in an effort to make them understand that this is part of the political program.
Okay. And what ways did you convey that? You had mentioned something about radio and...
But we used dialogues, sort of soap opera, which you could both use on radio and on television. A dialogue between people, somebody coming home, having been arrested by the police and horribly worried what was going to happen, and his wife explaining to him, yes, but I've heard that you have a human right to make sure that this process is done fairly. Oh, yes, is that so? And the woman explained, and at the end, somebody from the UN comes in and gives another explanation as well. But it's a bit of a soap opera, some funny, some not so funny. Some of it serious, but overall the idea was just to make it an everyday conversation in which these things, and they turned out to be very popular.
Oh, really?
They turned out to be very popular. I didn't think they would be, but it was 5-minute, 6-minute spots. They were aired frequently, and they were.
Yeah.
We hired a local singer, the Cambodian equivalent of the blues. Just to sing a song on human rights, and I still have it somewhere on tape, and I should have bought it, because it's a beautiful, he has a deep, dark brown voice.
Yeah.
And he sings about it. We used local puppet players and local artists to draw. So, as much as possible, trying to use local products, local language, and had Khmer writers and designers look at what we do and make it acceptable. Now these videos, pamphlets, folders were distributed throughout the country.
Okay.
Huge amounts, even to the extent where they came back to us used as packaging paper on the market. They were selling human rights folders as somebody had come up with an idea to fold it into a bag, and it was then sold in the market as bags, just paper bags.
Now, did they have radios that they could then listen to?
Oh, yeah, the radio and television was video was a big thing.
Okay.
They would run video on a generator or on a car battery. Organize it, 30 families would come and watch one video. So we made these videos and also in huge quantities. We had a reproduction facility that was kicking out these videos by the hundreds. And then we were handing them out for free to those who were running film and other programs around the countryside and elsewhere. So we reached a lot of people.
So they could be run kind of in a community setting?
Right.
And the UN was doing other kinds of information as well, right?
Yeah, we would go out and organize courses, try to reach, how would you call it, education multipliers. We would speak to teachers. Primary school teachers, secondary school teachers, university. We try and give them a program. We would go out also to professionals, judges, policemen. Yeah, we organize a seminar for senior policemen. All these, everybody who is involved with education or with the administration of justice itself, police, etc., try to reach them and talk to them and get these notions across. And they worked. It worked. It became a popular expression.
All right, now you also mentioned that you had run training programs.
Yeah.
So for judges, for lawyers, and so forth.
Yeah.
How did you set that up, and how long were the training programs, and how many sort of people went through it, and what was the goal?
I forgot some of the details, but let me mention first that the original budget of UNTAC did not contain any programming. So we had to go to extra budgetary resources to get funding for these kinds of programs.
Oh,
so we set
up
a trust fund for human rights education in Cambodia. We got about $1.5 million, which was enough to run several projects, have books printed, involve NGOs.
The books were printed on what were the books having to do with, just sort of laying down some legal parameters?
Well, it depends on the level you're trying to reach.
Okay.
But on the details of it, I'm not 100% sure.
Okay.
We brought in NGOs from outside, from the region, who have been active in the region and had similar experience. We tried to give them projects, that can execute projects, and the local NGOs as well.
Mm-hmm.
So we try not to do most of it ourselves.
Okay.
But basically try and get it out. The whole notion, Gene, of our work, if you want me to translate it in one sentence, was to ensure that we could leave and that it would be continued.
Okay.
The whole idea was to make our presence superfluous. We can come back to that later. This is what I remember on.
Okay. Yeah, I had wanted to ask you about the relationship with NGOs in the area of human rights. Did you work with some of the other, you know, sort of well-known human rights NGOs like Amnesty International or any large groups like that?
We did most of our work with the local NGOs who needed it.
Mm-hmm.
As to the international NGOs, I think should give this in a balanced way. That was support for our work, the party for Amnesty, the Ice Watch and others.
Yeah.
And that was useful and welcome, especially at the political level. When we came to Geneva, they supported our ideas to have a follow-up human rights office on them, and there was general support for everything.
Okay.
But something that was really rubbing the wrong way was the fact that most of these big NGOs with big funding used to come into Cambodia for 3 weeks with a high-level team, do a report, and criticize us.
Mm.
And then we would go back to them and say, well, you know, if you feel that strongly about it, come and help us.
Yeah, all right.
Come and help us set up a presence on the ground and get your feet wet.
Yeah.
And many of the big NGOs didn't do that. They say, no, this is not our mandate. We do advocacy or public awareness. We don't get our feet. We got some others to do that for us.
Mm.
And especially the Human Rights Watch was very critical of our efforts, and as could be expected, believed that the UN was subordinating human rights concerns to larger political questions. There is something to it. Of course, you can argue whether or not the situation was ready for democratic elections.
Mm-hmm.
Whether or not we were sufficiently forceful with those who violated human rights. Those are very, very difficult questions to implement. It's easy to criticize from a distance. It's a lot more difficult to actually do these things on the ground with the political material and other constraints that you have.
Right.
So, we tried to get these big NGOs to get active on the ground, and this is where they can make a tremendous impact. It would have been very helpful to have the Amnesty International expatriate presence in Cameroon.
Mm-hmm.
It would have been a great boost to the locals.
Yeah.
And instead you get these missions. And so that was a bit of, we had a difficult relationship with them. It was understood that they could be useful. On the other hand, these continuous missions and reports on our performance and criticism was rubbing the wrong way.
Okay. So in terms of a sustained way, what you were trying to do were the grassroots human rights groups.
Now, I told you earlier that there were some guys who saw that there was money in human rights, donor money. Get certain status by setting up your NGO. So there were a lot of them like it. We tried to work with those who were fairly serious. They had a huge membership after by the time we left. Offices in the provinces, a good network. They had their own legal assistance funds and procedures. They were providing lawyers to people who were arrested. They were monitoring court proceedings on their own, which is courageous, very much so. And some of them still operate with a fair amount of leadership, but they have to be really very careful in the political environment that we are in right now. At the time, with the presence of the UN and all the big political support that could be mobilized, they grew very, very fast. Some of them too fast, even, for their own good. Attracted a lot of support from outside. It was the thing to support from the local NGO. You can't go wrong with that. And that was, I think, an important success on the part of the human rights component to be able to support these. No, I don't think it was our success. It was the success of the Cambodians that took the opportunity, seized it, did well. I doubt that very much of the smaller NGOs have survived in the end. But still, the civic society is there. We tried also to work with some of the more professional organizations, journalists, students' associations. And it was, on a personal note, really, really nice to collaborate with those people. see them in their offices to have them talk to you about their problems and to help and point them in the right direction. It's a very slow process. It's from interpersonal contact, it's a grassroots thing to do.
What was the organizational relationship between Phnom Penh in the human rights component and then the officers or offices that you had in the province?
They report to the human rights component in Phnom Penh, but they would have to rely on the infrastructure means of other components. Particular civil administration.
Oh, okay.
But they're reporting went to us. And they were also guided by content. There were regular meetings of provincial human rights officers. In Phnom Penh, we would call them in, touch base, compare notes, feed instructions into them, give them material. And there were also frequent visits from headquarters to the field.
Okay.
A few of which I did myself, which was nice to go out and get a notion of what's going on and set up some programs there.
Yeah. How long did it take to get fully up and running?
That I don't know, but it took a fairly long time.
Like 7 months?
Yeah. The whole, it was a big operation. The feeling was that the UN at the time was not yet ready to field such a large operation. There was a tremendous amount of improvisation. And very good, skillful work by those at headquarters and administration in order to get this thing running.
Yeah.
But it took a long time. It took a very long time to get the right over eventually the rights officer in place and to get the equipment.
Yeah.
It took a long
time. Well, I was wondering if you could describe sort of a typical day or a typical week during your stay in Cambodia.
A typical day would include morning, which would start touching base with my supervisor. So where do we stand? What has happened? Do I need to go out on an investigation? No, that's not necessary. I would go to my desk, work on the text for these dialogues that we talked about,
writing
soap operas, or chase up the actual production of these things. I speak to a printer, go to the information component on whom we relied for the production of the videos and audio tapes.
Mm-hmm.
I spent a lot of time there to help direct these things. At times I would also go out in the field with a cameraman to shoot scenes of Cambodian life which have relevance to human rights. So it was a fair amount of writing, chasing up products, making products. I would go out to embassies, go with my director to take notes at meetings. It could possibly include any activity. Go out and teach myself with an interpreter, make a round of the NGOs, touch base, talk to them, what's going on, talk to me, what are your problems. So these are the kind of activities.
Were there language difficulties in terms of communicating with various different people within the human rights component, or did you use English primarily?
No, within the component, everybody spoke English. Some would speak French. A lot of the older Cambodians with education spoke French as well. But we were fortunate to have some real good quality interpreters local staff, with English, French, some with Russian. And that would, with a transparent communicator, you take your own temperature with you out and do a discussion, teaching. Basically, we didn't do the teaching, but the interpreters we did.
Yeah, okay. Right. Yeah, because it had to be done.
It all be done throughout.
Yeah. Did you ever fear for your own safety?
It was a high level of crime, especially at night. And foreigners were seen to be defenseless, especially the UN. We didn't have weapons. Our cars could be stolen at gunpoint. And there was also this notion that random violence could break out any time. It could be waiting for you around the corner. Somebody could decide to settle a dispute with a hand grenade. There was frequent shooting at night, including in the street where I lived. You hear a few shots and then nothing. In the morning you ask what happened and nobody knows. Nothing is happening. I was at night, I drove a motorcycle at the time. I drove very fast. The way to steal a motorcycle was to drive next to them and shoot the driver. And then simply pick up the bike. But mine was a serious, one of those little mopeds that
pointed
that I had a big 400cc bike and I drove really, really fast to make sure nobody got up. But there was a general idea that there was. There was risk, there was danger.
Yeah.
We hear shots fired almost every night. The UN was involved in several very sad cases of robbery and settling of personal scores.
The UN was involved?
Oh, yeah.
For what?
Well, for example, the case where these three Bulgarians were shot by the Khmer Rouge, which many took to be politically motivated. I have reasons to believe that that had to do with issuing a warning not to fool around with the local women.
Oh,
and
okay, these were Bulgarian peacekeepers, soldiers.
And in another instance, UNV, a Japanese UNV, was killed.
UNV?
The United Nations Volunteer.
Oh, volunteer, okay.
Who were taking care of the elections in the countries.
Oh, okay.
Was shot. Execution style, which was presumed to be because somebody had lost face over an appointment of the electoral staff. He had promised a family member that he or she would get a job with the electoral component. The UNV, who was in charge of that hiring, had said no. The guy had lost face. So then there was this, this happens. People were armed. There were a lot of arms around, M16s, AK-47s, pistols, hand grenades. They were all freely available. Crime was high. Money could be made very quickly. You could steal a car. A UN car could be sold for $5,000-$6,000 and then be shipped off to Vietnam, and your fortune was made. $5,000 for a Cambodian family would keep you alive for the next 10 years. So there was a great incentive for crime. That was the thing that worried me most. Not so much the political violence.
Okay.
That too was worrying. But it was this law and order, the settling of scores that you could be witness to.
What was, in your opinion, what was it like to have all of these foreigners suddenly arrive in Phnom Penh? I mean, all these different international contingents and the whole UN. And
it was, on the, you know, after hours, one big party. To be frank, yes. You get together, you talk.
Yeah.
It is hot.
Yeah.
So you can stay outside. Bars were cropping up left and right. All places to go to. You went to houses. The social life was good.
Yeah.
A lot of interesting people. And, the distinctions that you would usually have in an office between what is called here professional and general service staff would stay. Levels didn't matter really much. Everybody was on a first name basis.
Okay.
There was a good notion of a sense of mission.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Everybody was motivated and talking about the mission all the time. And it was a good atmosphere. And it was interesting.
Yeah. What about health conditions?
Health, everybody who came to Cambodia had the bug.